For this episode, we've partnered with Needed, the leading women's health supplement brand recommended by nutritionally trained practitioners. Did you know that 95% of women who take prenatals are still nutrient deficient? Most prenatals are designed to meet bare minimum needs, not to optimally nourish you. We love that Needed's products are based on the latest clinical research and that they focus on care before, during, and after pregnancy. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.
You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Carrie Bedient from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas, and this is another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I am joined by my fantastic, fearless, fierce, and flawless co-founders and co-hosts, Dr. Abby Eblin from Nashville Fertility Center.
Hey, everybody.
And Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
Hello, hello.
And we are joined today by Emily Patel, who is the founder and president of Hopeful Mama Foundation. And so we are delighted to have you here today, Emily, to talk about both the foundation and your personal experience, because both are very, very important things for patients to hear about from a couple different perspectives. So we'll dive into all of that in a minute. But you were telling us before we started recording that you're on your, was it fifth house in 6 years? So are you guys like burning
builders?
Like insurance money? Like what's
Carrie, you just met her. Can't you be a little nicer than that?
Oh, that was the nice thing. I mean, I didn't even propose that she was like a murderess getting rid of bodies or anything.
Just burning her houses down.
I would be the uncensored one out of Fertility Docs. So Emily, yeah. I'm so sorry. This is the first time that you're meeting me and finding out that I really and truly am
uncensored.
But anyway, you mentioned that you're building
a house
again.
Yes. So oddly enough, no, we're not burning them down for insurance. We're also not flipping homes. A lot of people have said, oh, you guys must be flipping homes because you're doing it so quickly. No, that is also not our intent. Everyone that we have either renovated or built, we said, oh, this is it. We're done. And it just, life hasn't happened that way. So yes, we are actually on our fifth house, which is our third build and two remodels. And we've done that in about 6.5 years. So we love to do do-it-yourself things, but this time we have a builder that we absolutely love, and we are building a farmhouse out in the countryside. And I'm telling you, this is the last one. I'm getting buried in the backyard.
So what part of the country do you live in?
So we're in Iowa. And
what part of Iowa?
We're in the Cedar Rapids area.
Oh, okay. I have a husband from Northwest Iowa.
so we're kind of like in the Rolling Hills, cornfield farm type area. Yeah.
And so that's pretty much Iowa though, right? Pretty much all of Iowa's that.
Pretty much. I mean, we moved to Arizona for a little bit, for 3 years actually, and we called it extended vacation because we ended up coming back to Iowa. We thought we would go to Arizona. We loved the sun. Everything would be perfect. And honestly, it just wasn't a good fit for us and our family. And so we moved back to Iowa, and I can't tell you how much the trees and the rolling hills, it's just like perfect for us and our family. So we're back, and hence we're building again. So,
So have you stayed in the same part of Iowa? So I am speaking as somebody who's in the third house on the same street in my neighborhood.
Okay. I didn't know that. Wow.
So yes, we are in Iowa. We're in the same area. I grew up in Dubuque, which is about 1 hour and 15 minutes from where we are now. But the general vicinity, we have been right around the Iowa City, Cedar Rapids area. Yes. And just kind of moving in different parts here. So
good stuff.
Well, it's nice that you've got somebody else who's doing the building for you this time, so that hopefully that makes it just a tad less stressful than having to haul out and actually do a lot of the work yourself.
Yes, I'll tell you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, here we go. The first house we remodeled was one that I had bought when I was single. And then when I met my husband, he decided to remodel it. And the funny story is before we even decided to do that, I asked him to help me hang something on the wall, and he didn't know how to use my drill. No idea how to use the drill. And then not even maybe 8 weeks later, he comes to me and he goes, you know, I think we should remodel this. And I said, you and me, the guy who can't use a drill, you want to remodel this house. But sure enough, that started our journey, and we remodeled it. We did it ourselves. ourselves. And, you know, it turned out beautifully. And then just a few short months later, here we were doing it again. So I don't know if we're just like pleasure seeking for like do-it-yourself jobs, but yeah.
At least you haven't shown up on any home remodeling shows, like, you know, the disaster remodel where the water's coming out of the ceiling. And so that's good. You guys, this is another skill you have that you never knew you had, I guess, until recently.
Yes, he did promise me if he ruined anything, he would call in the professionals. So that's kind of how he got me to agree to the remodels. But it actually was a great building. It's like for building, but it was a great experience for us together as a couple, because that's one of the most stressful things you can do. So then for us to go through IVF with the donor eggs, it was like, this is a breeze compared to all of this other stuff. So
there you go.
Compared to remodeling the house, though. We know
living in it. Yeah.
And living in it. Yeah. At the same time.
Yeah. All right. So Susan, what questions do we have today?
All right. So we have two questions. Our first one is from a listener who is most likely overseas. Hello. Does FSH injection dose affect egg quality? We did a round of 375 pergoveris and got 5 aneuploid in embryos, 32 years old. Our doctor wants to increase to 400, but I've read that high doses can affect quality.
How old is our listener?
She's 32.
32. I mean, there's always some data or some concern that perhaps if you have HMG or don't have HMG or have too much or too little, there's always kind of talk about, you know, maybe this can affect, you know, how mature the eggs are and therefore affect fertilization, and therefore affect development. But I don't think there's a lot of great data that really proves that FSH dose really has a direct impact on genetically abnormal embryos. So sometimes we need more medicine to get more eggs, and the more eggs we have, the more we have to choose from. But I know there is sort of an undercurrent. I know that people worry about that, but I don't know that there's a lot of hard and fast data that really says that.
And the practical matter of it is that you got 5 embryos, and that's a great number of embryos to have. And so I don't think adding more medication at this stage will necessarily change the underlying quality of them. Usually we're giving those meds to change the quantity. When you're talking about quality, like when we're doing an IUI cycle, for example, not really IVF, but an IUI cycle, people will oftentimes get a little bit better response from using gonadotropin. So all of the injectable FSH, other types of medications. And so there's a quality component of it there, but it's a very different pathway when you're talking about IVF. So I don't know that going from 370 to 400, which is really not
very,
like, that's, I would consider the doses essentially the same.
Same. Yeah. It's not,
you know,
not
if
a big
you
difference.
Got a full like 75 to 100 units, that's a difference. But 25 units is like, whatever. That's within the error of the medication dosing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that that's a huge functional difference for you. So I don't know that it's going to make much of a change besides increasing the cost of your medications a little bit.
Right. And remember, you know, IVF is a numbers game, unfortunately. And, you know, at 32, yes, statistically half of your embryos should have been normal. Okay. But, you know, that's an average over all populations when we're looking at this. And so, you know, oftentimes in this type of situation, I'd consider adding potentially some growth hormone to the situation. But sometimes just doing another cycle is all you needed to balance out your statistics. So, you know, I agree. Adding that 25 IUs is really, you know, a drop in the ocean. And I don't think that quality is really something you'd need to be concerned with that specific change. All right. Our next one is, thank you for all the information you provide. It really helps put my mind at ease just listening to you talk. Thank you so much for listening. My question is in regards to IUI trigger shots. My husband and I are currently waiting to see if our second IUI is successful and are considering IVF if the third IUI is not successful. Before the third IUI, I want to know if the timing of the trigger shot has an effect on our success. Everything I've read and even on my clinic's website suggests the trigger shot should be given 12 to 24 hours before the IUI. However, the last two cycles, they have been administered the shot in the office while performing the first IUI. We do back-to-back days. Should I be advocating for something else? Does this waste the first washed semen sample? Thank you.
So there's a lot of layers to that question.
Yes. Go for it, Abby. Pick the layer you want and then we'll go from there.
Okay. The layer I want is back-to-back IUI cycles. You know, when I first started 20 plus years ago, a few people still did that. There's really not data to show that it makes a difference. The sperm can survive in the female reproductive tract for several days. In fact, there's a really old study in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed that couples who kept track exactly of when they had sex and exactly when they ovulated, they actually took the woman's urine and could do real specific tests to know when she ovulated. Some couples could get pregnant with having one episode of intercourse up to 5 days before the egg ovulated. They found that within about about 24 hours of release of the egg, though, if the sperm wasn't there, the egg didn't fertilize. So really, it's more important to have the sperm there before the egg if you had to choose one or the other. And there's really no exact way to know when the egg releases. You know, we can see the follicle, but we can't see the egg pop out. So I think your clinic is doing a great job, actually, because they're doing IUI. If anything, they're doing it a little bit earlier than when the egg releases. And so the sperm should be able to survive for that full length of time and shouldn't be a hindrance to you getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm. And the 12 to 24 trigger time frame, a lot of it is dependent on exactly how you're measuring it, because there's a difference between seeing a follicle that's large on an ultrasound and giving a trigger shot versus getting a positive ovulation predictor kit, because the predictor kit's going to go positive generally after you see that big follicle and after in a much closer time frame to when the egg actually pops out, because the ovulation predictor kit is responding to the information your body's giving compared to the ultrasounds that we're doing in the office, where we're getting that information before the instruction signals have been given. And so some of it depends on some of those nuances of, you know, are you also using an ovulation predictor kit? Is that timing when, because some clinics will use that and then they'll give a trigger shot on top of it. And so that's going to change your timing as well. And it, that depends on the nuances of what your clinic's doing. I think overall, you haven't wasted anything because the sperm is there before the egg has come out. And ultimately, that's the most important thing. 12 versus 24 hours is not a make or break kind of situation here. And so I think you're fine. I think it's just knowing IUI is, in best case scenario, are usually hovering somewhere around a 15% success rate. And so that's 85% of people at the end of that month we're going to get bad news to. So I don't think there's any major medical issue going on here.
I think there is a study published just within the last year or two that looked at timing of IUI success rates. And really, it said anything between 12 and 36 hours was completely equivalent and made absolutely no difference in success rates. You know, I think you haven't wasted anything. I think you're doing fine. This is definitely an area where there's an art to the medicine that's getting accomplished. And so there's going to be regional differences. There's going to be physician differences between practices. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that anything is wrong here. And we wish you the best on your third IUI.
Yeah.
All right. So Emily, we are so glad to have you with us today. And before we dive too much into the Hopeful Mama Foundation, tell us how you got introduced to the world of infertility and fertility treatment and all of that. Like what brought you into this very special universe?
Yes, it's the universe. We say that we're so grateful to meet the people that we meet, but just wish it was in a different setting, right?
Yes.
So for me, my journey, it started a long time ago when I was 16, actually, and I started having hot flashes and night sweats and mucous membrane dryness and headaches. And so we went and saw the doctor and they said, oh gosh, you're just hormonal. You're a teenager. Let's put you on some birth control and that'll fix everything. And you know what? It did. Seemingly fixed everything. So on I went with my life until I was 25 and I needed to have a heart procedure done. And so they needed me to come off all my medication for that procedure. And so during that time, I started feeling kind of funny again. I was like, gosh, I'm getting really hot and I'm having some headaches and I'm sweating at nighttime and everything is so dry and I can't remember much. My brain feels funny. So I decided to make an appointment with an OBGYN because I didn't know what was going on. I just thought I felt funny. And so I went in and I remember sitting down and saying, you know, I don't know what to tell you other than I feel like I'm in menopause. And I started laughing because I was 25. I thought there's no way I'm in menopause, but this is just how I can tell you how I feel so you understand. Well, then she came back. And when she walked in the room, I remember vividly her face. I'll never forget it because it was one of those moments where I was like, oh no, I'm actually in menopause. Like what? And so from there, I ended up going to a specialist and was diagnosed with, at that time, they called it premature ovarian failure. Now it's more, you know, on a range of premature ovarian insufficiency. Mm-hmm. But my AMH was at 0.08 and my FSH was around 130. And so at that point, we had done diagnostic testing with ultrasounds. And unfortunately, my right ovary was just gone, essentially, and my left had not even a follicle really left. So that's kind of how I was quickly and rapidly introduced into the infertility world and was told that I probably would never have children of my own because of that. And even though I was a nurse, I didn't know much about the reproductive side of medicine. I worked in the emergency department. So anytime OB things came in, we're like, you're going to OB, go on, go.
As they do in the ER, they send them quickly to labor and delivery.
And so I didn't know much about it. And so I kind of just believed that for a long time. I was like, I'm just not going to ever have children. And if I want to, I'll have to go the adoption route or something. And that's kind of how I was introduced and how my journey started.
When did you start seeing your reproductive endocrinologist to help build your family?
That was actually many years later, and relationships later, and life changes and events later. I had actually gone through a private adoption that was unsuccessful in between that time. And then I finally started seeing a reproductive endocrinologist once my husband and I were married, and I had found out about donor eggs, because again, I also didn't even know donor eggs was an option when I was diagnosed. And my husband is a physician, and he said, can I look at your medical records when we were dating? And I was like, oh, maybe? I don't know.
That's and a little so personal.
It was, but he looked at them and he goes, you know, Emily, I just want to let you know that yes, your ovaries are not working, but your uterus is just fine. Everything here shows your uterus can carry a baby. And I was like, what do you mean? And so that's how I learned about donor eggs. And then shortly after we got married, it was in 2016, that December of 2016 was our first appointment with a reproductive endocrinologist in Chicago.
And so you had mentioned to us that you had a little bit of even more unique story. You have two children and they're both from different egg donors. So how did that come about?
Yes. So when we first started the process, the clinic we were using had their own egg bank, which I found to be really seamless. And so we selected the donor that we were going to use for our first cycle. And then we'd had our transfer in January of 2017. And then we were very blessed and our first cycle took. And so that is our oldest daughter. Aww. She is 6 years old, 6 years old now. She'll be seven in October. Aww. And so, when we were ready to try again, when she was just not two yet, we had reached back out to our clinic and our donor still had another lot of eggs. So we were able to use those and we did a second cycle. Unfortunately, we didn't have any blast come from that cycle. We still ended up transferring the best two that we had just kind of as like a Hail Mary. And unfortunately, it didn't take. And so I was devastated at that time. I'll tell you, and I share this story often, that I was going to be done because I felt like I had compromised so much in my life related to parenthood, that if my children couldn't at least be fully genetically related, then I was done. And I sat in that for a long time until my husband tried pulling me out of the dark cave and said, you're really not going to complete our family or, you know, try when you have this desire to just because it's not going your way. And I was like, yeah. Not going my way, I'm done. And I said, I'm done compromising. And he's like, I think you're going to regret that someday. And you know what? He was right. And as hard as it was to hear that, he pulled me out and we went back to the clinic. We found another donor that had so many similarities. I actually asked, are they related somehow? Like, are they cousins? Are they somehow related? They're like, no, they're not. And we selected her and then we had a third cycle and Everly is here and she will be 4 in May.
Well, that's awesome.
That's fantastic. And one of the other things that's also really cool and somewhat unique is that you said both your girls can tell their own stories.
Yeah,
they can. So it was something that was very important to my husband and I that we be very open with them. I had done a lot of research and reading prior to moving down the donor egg route. And a lot of donor conceived people who were not ever shared their story from birth on, it was very hard to hear that as an adult or as an older person. And so that was something I knew that we just needed to start early. We needed to start often. And it needed to be consistent. And so right when we brought her home, I tell you, I had some books that talked about donor conception, specifically egg donation, and I would just read them to her because I was scared. I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to screw it up. I didn't want to make her feel any way when she got older. And so I just started reading the books every single day. Aww. When I was rocking and feeding her, I just read her the books. And honestly, I found that by the time she could start to understand, which for her was about 2 years old, it was so easy because I had been saying it to her for 2 years. And now she was just like, oh yeah, mommy, our helper. We call our donors our helpers at this age. Our helpers just gave you that special egg because yours weren't working. And now you have me. And
that is so cool.
It was, yes, it honestly was like for me, the best way to start it because I didn't know what I was doing. And then when we had our second one, it was much easier because our oldest was already talking about it. And about so she was just like, about the helpers. Yeah. So she was like, oh, Everly, our oldest is Penelope. She goes, Everly, you have your own helper. Isn't isn't that so cool? And she gave us this and we needed the doctor. That. And I mean, and so, yes, I just actually shared a video on my social media about Everly, our youngest, telling us her story. And it actually surprised me because when I asked her how many people it took to make her, she said five. And I said, five? It's supposed to be three. And she goes, well, it was the doctor. It was the helper. It was daddy, mommy, and sissy. And so.
That is really sweet.
Her story was so sweet because she was including her whole family. And so I learned a lot about how they do tell their own story as you tell it to them and they make it their own. It's really sweet.
That is beautiful. That is beautiful.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Emily. I think that is one of the biggest fears, I think, for most of my patients who have children that are conceived with donor eggs, donor sperm, or donor embryos. They just don't know really how to tell them. I think that's a great story. That's awesome. I love that.
Thank you.
So how open were you guys with your, like, your communities as you were going through this? Because at this point now, all right, been there, done that. The kids know it's all open. Yeah. So how open were you guys with your friends and family as you were in the middle of this?
Yeah. So because I had been diagnosed long before I met my husband, it was something that my friends and family already knew. Unfortunately, relationships had suffered also because of that diagnosis. So my life was much different than it was when I got diagnosed. So everyone kind of knew this is Emily's situation and she can't have kids. That's pretty much just how it was out there. So then once I met my husband and he told me about the option for donor eggs, I started telling everybody because I was like, good news. I can become a mom and I can potentially carry our child. And so I like blasted it from the rooftops. I was like, this is a blessing. Guess what can happen? And so honestly, probably maybe a little too much, I was telling the world and I was very open about it. I had no shame in my mind. It was an answer to prayer for me because absolutely. I was like, this is awesome. So we actually shared our journey the whole way through. Our friends and family knew. They knew when we were going to do cycles. They knew when we did a transfer. We were just very open about it. And for us, that worked. It worked well for us. And then since then, obviously, we've been very open with our children and our friends now and our social communities as well know about that. So
how did all of that springboard into Hopeful Mama?
So it actually, it started when Penelope, our oldest, was 6 weeks old. I was holding her in my arms and Samir was working a 24-hour shift in the ER and I was there alone and I was holding her and I looked at her and I thought, I just started sobbing. And I thought, you know, I can't believe that A, I had this opportunity. But second of all, there's so many women who want this moment and I can't handle the fact that because of the lack of resources or lack of education or finances or insurance coverage that they're not going to be able to experience this because a lot of mine was a lack of education for a long time. And so that's kind of where something started right in here that was like, you need to do something about this. And it wasn't until, you know, Penelope just turned 6. So it wasn't until she was 5 that I actually was able to have Hopeful Mama really born. And it started last year when we moved back from Arizona and I was in between, am I going to stay home with the kids? Am I going to go back to nursing? And Samir and I, my husband, were talking. He's like, you know, I think maybe this is the time that you should start this dream of yours. And I thought, are you sure? And he's like, yes, this is the perfect time. And so honestly, we started in January and just honestly, it just took off. We launched in April and it has just been full steam ahead since then.
Receptiva DX is a powerful test that can help detect inflammatory conditions on the uterine lining that might be preventing you from becoming pregnant or staying pregnant. If you've experienced implantation failure or recurrent pregnancy loss, ask your doctor about Receptiva DX testing. If found, uterine inflammation can be treated, providing a new pathway to achieving a successful pregnancy. Receptiva DX, because the journey's worth it.
So how do people find out about you and what does it mean when they get involved with your organization? What services do you offer?
Yes, definitely. So we have a large presence on social media. We have a website as well. And so there's kind of two caveats to that. So Hopeful Mama supports women on their infertility journey in 3 ways. So we do that through local support group and also virtual support groups. We hold educational workshops that are quarterly and then those are in person, but we also started filming them so they can watch them later on our YouTube channel. now. And then we are just launching fertility grants this April, which is so exciting because we're not even a year old yet and we're already able to give back financially with grants. So we're just so excited about that. And so those are the services that we offer. So if someone finds us, let's say through social media or our website or just different avenues that we're out in media, they can join our support groups virtually. If they're not local, they can watch our YouTube channel, which has all of our workshops on it. If they are local, then they can come to in-person groups. We host events that are coping strategies. We have emotional workshops. We have counselors coming. We have pelvic floor therapists that come. We have lots of different people that come and talk to us. And then from a just like volunteer standpoint, we already have a volunteer team of close to 10, which has been such a blessing as well. And they help through making flyers or working at events or telling people about the support that we offer. We have our big fundraising event coming up in April. So we've had a lot of volunteers helping with that. We have people helping with social media. We have people working with Pinterest. We have a volunteer in Paris who does all of our Pinterest work, which is just so exciting that we're not just nationally, but we're globally. So that's been really exciting.
So how many events have you had in the past year? Because you, like you said, you're really new. You've only been in existence for a little over a year. Is that right?
Actually under a year. We haven't actually, we didn't launch until April. So our birthday is essentially in April.
Wow.
And so we for event side of things, we've only had one big fundraising event, which was in the fall, which we called Sip and Shop for Hope. And you could come to a coffee shop, get coffee and shop some vendors, and the proceeds went back to the foundation. We just recently did a coping workshop, which was an event that you could come to and you learned about calligraphy for 2 hours that you could then use as a coping strategy when things maybe were stressful and you're like, you know what, I just need to dill. I need to just sit in this moment and focus on something. And calligraphy is perfect for that because I learned you have to do it very slowly.
Yeah, that's a great, like a mindfulness activity kind of.
Yeah. So those are just the two like event style things that we've had, but we have a lot of events coming up this year outside of the workshops that we've had. And those again are the educational workshops and those we have 40. So we've had 3 of those so far.
Wow.
So when we're talking about kind of having local or regional type interactions and support groups and things like that, where are you currently located and where are you hoping to go?
So we're currently located, the in-person ones are in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the Marion area. We're kind of like a little tri-county area here, but we have a couple things in the works, which we're really excited about. We're looking at potentially expanding into the Des Moines area. And then we're also looking at expanding into the Washington, DC area. We have some volunteers and some ambassadors that are looking in those areas to start expanding our in-person support groups there, which would then grow into events and workshops that we could host once we kind of got up and running. But from a virtual standpoint, anyone can join from anywhere. And like I mentioned, we have people joining us from all different countries, which has been really exciting to see from the support group side of things.
How do people apply for the grants that you have available? Because that's such a huge barrier for so many people. How does that work?
Sure. So our grants haven't opened yet, and they're going to be opening in the spring. So once they do open on our website, it will, right now there's like a grant application page that says coming soon. And we're just revamping that. It's going to go live again in just a few days. We were just putting a timer and some other things on there, but they'll be able to download the medical form, which is pretty much the biggest part of the grant for our standpoint, so that they can start working on that now before the grant applications even open. And then once they open, it's all on our website. And we made it very simple because I'll tell you, when I was looking at other grants for myself and also just in this, they are daunting. There's 16 pages and you have to submit this stuff and you have to pay $200 or $50 for an application fee. And so the board of directors and I decided we didn't want that for Whole Mama. So we have no application fee. It's a one-page grant application that you just fill out. You have to submit the med form, which again, that's the biggest chunk for us, is that medical evaluation form that has to be done by the physician with them. But outside of that, it's very streamlined so that we could find the greatest need from the people that are applying and make sure that that's who we're awarding the grants to.
Do people applying for the grants have to submit their tax forms and things like that? I know that's a common part of grant applications often.
So no, for us, we are not requiring that. We're asking for them to show that they have medical insurance, not fertility coverage, but medical insurance to cover the mom and the baby. But other than that, it's not like they have to have fertility coverage. We just want to make sure that you're able to go to prenatal appointments and take care of the baby and yourself during that time. So the other thing about our eligibility requirements, I guess you could say, is Hope for Mama is geared towards women with an infertility diagnosis. The relationship status doesn't matter. You just have to be a woman who has an infertility diagnosis and you can apply. And so outside of just showing that you have insurance and that medical form and appropriate living arrangements, those types of things, there's not a lot of submitting of documents that we are requiring.
That's great.
How involved is that medical document that the docs are doing? So we kind of know.
Yeah. Like how involved is the questionnaire?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you like know,
the part that we're going to end up filling out for our patients.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the first section is for the patient. It's basically just sharing a little bit about their medical history and what they've done. The medical portion for the physician or the licensed healthcare provider, because we wanted to make sure that if someone is seeing someone that's not a physician, they can also fill that out. Yes. We didn't want to, you know, make it even more hard.
Practitioner. Yeah.
So yeah. So for that standpoint, it's not that hard. It's kind of just like a physical assessment, any type of like a quick physical assessment that you would do for a regular physical. And then talking about any type of medical diagnosis that could impact the fertility treatment side of things. So it's 2 to 3 pages. But honestly, when I was helping create it with our vice president, who's a physician, you know, we tried to just make it as clear and streamlined as possible so that it didn't take a lot of your time, but it gave us, the board, the information that we needed to make sure that they are safe to move forward with treatment.
Absolutely.
And I'd be happy to share the form with you too. Soon it will be on our website. So I can also just send it your way.
I'm sure we'll see it from patients pretty quickly here.
Yeah.
If you had some advice for our listeners who are looking for a community to be a part of, what do you find kind of sets your group apart from others?
Sure. I think what sets Hopeful Mama apart from other infertility nonprofits is the fact that we focus more We focus on more than just the finances, because as much as I know fertility treatments cost so much money, support and emotional side of things and education is just as important. And a lot of infertility nonprofits don't cover the education side, and they're also not offering support groups. So at Hopeful Mama, you're kind of getting the whole picture. You're getting finances, you're getting support emotionally, encouragement, you're talking to peers that are in the same or close to the same situation as you, and then you're being able to have access to educational workshops. The other thing that sets us apart is everything we offer is free. There is no charge for anything that they do. Now, let me put one caveat. If you come to an event and it's ticketed because we're fundraising, that is a little different. Like if you're going to come to our bowling event, you'll have to pay for that. But any resources, any workshops, support groups, it is all free. So that was another thing. I didn't want to make Hopeful Mama something that they have to pay for even more based on everything else they're doing. So,
well, that's great.
Great. That really helps improve access to people who otherwise
wouldn't
reach out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From a POI perspective, for people who have ovarian insufficiency, do you have any advice for those women who are kind of in the stages of figuring out what's going on, have just learned about this really devastating diagnosis?
Yeah, very traumatic.
It changes your entire self-view.
Yeah.
Any advice for those patients?
Oh gosh, you know, that hits me right in here, because I haven't thought about that a lot, because it is, you're right, it's such a devastating diagnosis, and it can really impact your self-worth and how you feel about yourself. And so I would have to say that just from, I guess, my personal experience is that I have learned through my journey that what my body can do isn't what makes me valuable. What my body can produce or give to somebody is not what makes somebody love me. They love me for who I am, not what I can do for them. And that was something that was really hard to come to terms with, because I was like, I can't give this person a child. I can't give this person, I can't give myself a child. Like, I'm not worthy. I'm broken. And that's how I felt for so long, and navigating the loss of genetics and realizing what that means and what that looks like and how will people view me. I finally was able, through a lot of time and effort, to realize that I am still valuable. I am still worthy. And my relationship with my donor conceived children has the genetics has been the least,
doesn't matter. Yeah.
The least part of what has made me a mom to them. It actually hasn't played a role at all, other than us just sharing our story. And I didn't realize that at first. I didn't realize that genetics didn't really play the relational side of things. You know, there's such a huge importance on the genetics and the honesty there. But so I think for someone going through POI and having that self-worth concern and feeling like they're broken, there's so much your body can do, and it's not, your worth is not, you know, based on what it can perform, is kind of how I grew through that.
Wow. Those were some very powerful words of wisdom. That was great, Emily.
Oh gosh, thanks.
Fantastic.
Wow. I don't know what else to say after that.
That nails it right there. One of the things I love most about this podcast is the ability to talk to people who have been there, done that, and are taking all of that drama and angst and pain and vaulting it into to just really incredible things. And so having a place where we can send patients to say, hey, you are not alone. Other people are with you. And even being able to, some of my favorite episodes to tell patients about are episodes exactly like this one, mm-hmm. where we can say, okay, this person has been through something similar to what you are going through. Give it a listen. And just people knowing that they're not alone is so incredibly important. Thank you so much for sharing all of this.
Thank you for the work that you're doing. I mean,
yeah,
you've accomplished in a year is absolutely amazing. And we look forward to seeing where Hopeful Mama goes in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
So to our audience, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all those places. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. So hop on by, leave us a like or a follow and say hello. And don't forget to hit subscribe.
You can also visit fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit a specific questions you have about infertility. All questions will be answered on the podcast anonymously for our Ask the Doc segment. So don't hold back. We also love episode ideas. So let us know what you're wanting to think, what you're wanting to hear.
And think. This podcast is intended for entertainment. It's not a substitute for medical advice from your physician. Thanks for joining us. See you guys next time. Bye.
Bye.
Fertility is complex, and while there's a lot we can't control in the journey to parenthood, nutrition is a big one that both partners can. This is why we've teamed up with Needed, a perinatal nutrition company that optimizes nutrition for both partners throughout all stages of pregnancy. They offer a variety of products to support women and their partners on their journey to conception, including their fertility support for tube plan. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off with your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.